back in a new Play-Doh. It's that fresh Play-Doh smell.
Is that like
I ate it? I ate it. I just wanted to try it just to remember childhood.
Is it edible? Yes. No. Yes, it is.
It was much worse. Please, dear God, don't put this in.
This is Remote Ruby.
Have you any remote idea to the meaning of the word?
Hey.
Hey.
What's up?
So what's up?
It's like the episode of The Office. Oh, and Kevin's like, why say many words when few do?
Yeah. I love that show. So good.
I love my mom, but she has a really solid history of buying me. Like, she's always like, I got to get you Christmas gifts that I choose, you don't ask for. And usually they kind of miss the mark. But this year she like went all in on office stuff. And so like I have like face mask from The Office and a calendar, which I won't use the calendar, but I was like, this is a nice gesture. You did good this year, mom.
Yeah. We should start doing the intro that's got some ridiculous little thing. That was always my favorite part of the show.
My favorite intro is the one where Dwight does the fire drill and he sets fires all throughout. The amount of chaos in that 3 minutes where like Oscar's throwing cats through the ceiling and they're falling out.
Oh, yes. The one I always think of was when they keep putting nickels in Dwight's phone and it gets heavier and slowly, but then eventually they take them all out and he just hits himself in the head with it.
It's one of the most clever shows of all time. It is.
I've seen it too much. I've seen it so much that it would blow your mind. I had an ex who had it on all the time. And dude, after so many times through, Michael Scott just gets unbearable.
Wronged.
No, it's true.
This is a bad take. This is a bad take.
My Megadesk is my favorite.
Megadesk is good. Also, when he puts Dwight's desk in the bathroom and then calls him and is like, hey, what are we selling this stock for? And he's looking it up. When the pandemic ends, I have a note I've been taking of all the trivia names, like for office trivia, because we used to go to that, all the team names I could use. And even reading them on this podcast would be offensive. So, and they're just straight from the show.
But. Oh, yes. So what's new with you guys this week?
So follow up from last week, I was talking about moving and archiving repos. I successfully did it somehow. I started looking for another tool again, and I was like, wait, this is stupid. I can just write Ruby. So I used the OctoKit gem, and then probably, what, an hour after we finished the recording, I was like, I did it. So I have a new GitHub org that's like androidcodes-archive. And I have moved all my archived repos over there, private and public ones. And now I only have 40 repos and all my Git notifications are now like I stay up to date on them. It's perfect.
So you have doubly archived projects now.
Yeah, but they're just not in my way. They're public and I've linked to them from blog posts and things like that. And Chris, you were right. The redirect still does work. So,
That's good.
Now it's out of my way and there's no notifications and Dependabot's not freaking out anymore. And it's just wonderful.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my gosh. Yeah, because I have 300 some repos for GoRails episodes. And yeah, my Dependabot email is pretty long usually. So maybe I should be doing something like that.
Dependabot's a blessing and a curse.
It's a double-edged sword. If you have tests and you just add that little Dependabot like config in your repos and you're consistent about it, then you can have them auto-merged once the tests pass. And that's great.
That's cool.
But if not, then it's not that great.
Our problem with Dependabot has been all these like front-end libraries that are like dependencies of the React code. We all have a really good idea of like the Ruby dependencies and what to look for and what's changed. We have really comprehensive tests for Ruby. We have tests for React. I'm really scared to merge this in.
Well, you can set it per language config. So like you can say like every week, update the Ruby dependencies and then set the node dependencies to not update.
Huh.
Or only update the development ones, for instance.
That would probably work. Yeah, there's a lot of just a large volume of stuff to deal with that. It's super useful, but finding the right balance is, I have my core projects that I want it on, but everything else is like, nope, don't need it. But
yeah,
it is kind of nice if you ever come back to a project though, a long time later, and you're like, here's all these issues that I can just go boop, merge them all and just be done with it. It's been kind of nice to pick up some old projects like that.
Yeah. Moving all these repos has allowed me to do is like, oh, these are the projects I care about. And now I've started to go through and update them and maybe fix a few things. I also tested and perfected like the perfect gem release workflow, which has been super nice as well. So now every time I use conventional commits, which is prefixing your commit with like chore or feature, which is like abbreviated to feat. And there's several, you can look it up. It's conventionalcommits.org, I think. And I've been using that for a while and I typically don't have a lint or anything, but there are several that exist. Every time I merge a commit into main, I have a GitHub action that checks that and it opens a new PR for the release. And so it uses semantic versioning. So if I have a bunch of little bug fixes, it'll open a release PR to bump a patch version and it will auto create the change log or auto update the change log and auto set the version. So as soon as I'm ready to release like a new version of the gem, all I have to do is hit merge on that PR and it creates the GitHub release. It creates the GitHub tag. It puts the changes from the change log into the GitHub release and it releases it on Ruby gems.
That's cool. Yeah. So the change log's actually generated from like all the activity on the repo since the last one or?
They uses the conventional commits stuff. Like there's a conventional commit like change log thing and it uses bugs, I think bugs, features, and that's it. There's a few types of conventional commit prefixes you can use, and it uses those to determine what goes in the changelog. So like features and bug fixes will go in there, but for instance, like a chore, I don't know, update the README, for instance, that wouldn't go in the changelog.
Gotcha. That's cool.
Yeah. Seems pretty handy. Seen a few projects using that, and it seems pretty convenient because otherwise you're going to write those manually in the changelog, and it's kind of automating all that. So,
right. And what you actually mean is you're not going to write them in the change log.
Right. You don't have to that way.
And this also ensures that your contributors don't have to update the change log.
What happens with my like 27 work in progress commits in a row or like fix as I'm trying to get CI working?
Please work. Well, please work.
Are you committing those to main or are you committing those in a branch?
We always push straight to main, right?
Well, if you push straight to main and but it depends on what you prefix the commit with. If you prefix it with chore, then it won't go in the changelog.
Right. Does it just ignore the ones that don't have a prefix?
I always use the prefix. I haven't even tried it without one. That's just how I write Git commits now. I've been doing it for years.
Well, I figure if you've got an open source project and you want to try to adhere to it, chances are people in there PRs or something might not do that or whatever.
Yeah, but that's fine. I always squash merge.
Yeah.
And so when I squash merge a PR, I can set the commit title.
Right.
So that's not an issue.
Yeah. I mean, if some other contributor had access or whatever, just in case a commit came in without the prefix, it probably just ignores them or something.
I assume it ignores them or they just wouldn't go in the change log, but you could also set up linters if you wanted to. I've done that in the past to just ensure that's what happens. But yeah, it's awesome if you're a single person working on a repo. You may have to think a little bit more if it's not just you.
Yeah, sounds like something to try out. I could definitely see that because I'm more or less doing that already for Peg and whatever else I'm working on that's open source and stuff. So I like it. I'm going to have to go check it out. What did you say the domain was?
The domain for the commit convention is conventionalcommits.org. I will link to a repo that uses this workflow.
Yeah, cool. That way anybody else can try it out.
Proud of you for your big Git energy.
Thank you. I love that phrase now. I'm going to use that.
That's the title of this episode.
Big Git energy. Yeah, it has to be.
Nope. Chris, anything cool with you?
Oh, did a ton of stuff this week. I had a really fun random live stream I did the other day with basically this guy, Freak Vanderherten.
I can't pronounce his company's name. It's like S-A-P-T-I-E.
Yeah. Beatty or something.
Yeah, that dude is a huge Laravel contributor.
Wow, he's got 27,000 followers on Twitter. One of his apps, which is really cool, it's called Ray. So imagine like you're building your Rails app and you're doing puts debugging and you're just reading the logs and trying to find your messages in the query logs and everything else that's being printed out. Ray is a little desktop app that you run and you can send over literally any variable, strings, booleans, objects, whatever, and it will dump them into, you know, a pretty printed version in that window. So it's like its own little web server that runs in development. And you can go and pause the process for a minute and you can print out different things and it will link to the source code and all of that. And he was wanting to add, I guess he's already got Node.js and maybe Python support or something, but wanting to add Ruby support. And somebody tagged me in the tweet and I was like, yeah, you know, let's do a live stream or whatever and I'll help out and build the kind of the bare bones of the library. So we did a live stream and basically he just walked me through, you know, the code for the PHP version and how it works. And we built a gem and replicated that in a couple hours and did the basics of if you send over a string or a Boolean or whatever, it'll just make the API request and it works in Ruby now, which was pretty cool. So it was a fun little live stream. We'll have to add a link to it so that if anybody's interested, they can watch that. It's now available, so if anybody wants to play with that in Ruby or add, there's a bunch of open issues of features to add and stuff. But yeah, just a fun little project. And I thought it was such a smart idea for debugging. But we have some nice, really nice tools though, like Binding IRB and Pry and Bybug. But we still do puts quite often. And Ray was such a nifty little idea. So I was really excited to see that now have Ruby support.
That's cool that you live streamed it. I bet that was fun.
Yeah, it was fun because we just DM'd a little bit and we're like, yeah, let's just do it and see what happens. So we did it all live and he's such a nice guy. So they do some cool stuff in PHP land as well, as we've talked about many times.
I caught some of it. Yeah, it was fun to watch, especially because I was like, I've written PHP, but the type of PHP you like put in like an HTML file. So it was fun to see like real PHP.
Yeah, because my goal is, you know, he's got all these classes for different things and being able to replicate that as best we could one-to-one in Ruby would make maintenance of that really easy. So if you need to introduce something across, you know, if you're maintaining 5 or 10 of those libraries, then you got to write it 5 or 10 times in different languages, which is a pain if they're all written differently. So that was what I was trying to do is it's a class for this. So we'll try and replicate that with a class and all while sticking to a little bit of the Ruby-ishness things.
Yeah. I also saw you live streamed, or maybe you didn't live stream. I didn't get a chance to watch it, but you and a couple other people were doing some product streaming too. How was that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So we bought 12and12.io and I want to build stuff and just build some small things and kind of just document the whole process of picking a domain and deciding on what it's going to do and whatever. So John Hainstock and Peter Askew of the Vidalia Onion fame, he and John and I got on a Zoom and just chatted for like 2 hours about building job boards and domaining and whatever. It was a blast. He's such an interesting guy. He's famous for the VidaliaOnions.com domain that he bought and like just accidentally now sells onions for a living. And the post is amazing because he's like, I get these people who call asking about like the crop this year, how's it doing and whatever. and it's like its own little cult. And it just is amazing to see that stuff. But one of the things that I really like about him is, you know, most startups that you think about, like building a product, you're like, I have to go invent something new and I have to go build all this hard tech and just do something crazy like blockchains or whatever. And then you come to this guy and he's, yeah, I found this good expiring domain, Vidalia Onions, and just called up a farmer who farms onions and like, can I sell them? And they're like, yeah, it's not really any different than mail order. So yeah, sure. And now he has a giant business doing that. His point with a lot of it was like, people just go to their browser and they're like, want to look up Vidalia onions, and they just type in VidaliaOnions.com and assume that's a thing. Like, they don't search the words Vidalia onions. They just go directly to the .com because that's what they think about. So he was like, yeah, you buy a domain like that and you're just going to get traffic. That's just how it works because people are doing this. So if you buy that domain, you can turn it into a business really easily because you've instantly got traffic to it. You're not like trying to get SEO and post links or whatever. Like, boom, you bought the domain, you have traffic. Now it's whatever you want to do with it. And I was like, such a good point. There's a lot of low-hanging fruit that you could just go build and make 10K a month just with it. A lot of his are like job boards as well. And Vidalia Onions is in the same kind of group, I guess. But yeah, fascinating guy. He's a blast to talk to.
That's super cool. You said you're getting into job boards. Are you looking at building like a kind of broad job board? Are you looking at targeting developers, even Ruby developers? What are you thinking?
I obviously get a lot of jobs sent to me on LinkedIn and stuff. And I try and repost them in our Slack and, you know, share them with other people. But I was like, you know what? We should just make a job board for Go Rails and post as many Rails jobs on there as Ruby and Rails jobs as I can find. And the other thing too was, you know, I feel like you could use a job board for good too and encourage people to post apprenticeships and things like that. And also include the other side of the market of like people who are looking for an apprenticeship or a junior position or whatever. Maybe companies just stumble on that and hire them without like a normal application process. So that's kind of my goal, just thinking about, can I put something simple together and, you know, launch that in a week or two. And then John and I were talking about, could we turn it into a platform? And yes, we can, but it instantly adds a ton of complexity because if you have to charge people to use your job board and they got to charge their customers, you're into marketplace payments. And so I'm working on adding that to pay eventually, which I need anyways, you know, one step at a time, launch the Go Rails job board specifically for that, then probably pull it back into like a generic job board software or something. I don't know if we'll ever go that far on it. It's hard to market that stuff and you got a lot of legwork to make that into a thing, but we might do that. We'll see.
That's cool. Yeah, I like the idea of juniors posting, like looking for jobs. That seems to be, from my point of view, the biggest, I don't know, the most frustrating thing right now is that we have a lot of junior developers who can't get Ruby jobs because most Ruby jobs are expecting a few years of experience or a lot of them are just senior roles. I don't have an answer for it. I feel like if it continues this pattern of we teach Ruby in boot camps and then they can't get jobs, that these boot camps are going to stop teaching Ruby.
Yeah, and a lot of them already have, except for Lowagon and probably a couple others. That's been a real pain point in the community, and hopefully it'll change. But you know, I don't. Do you guys hire any interns or apprentices at Podia right now?
Not right now. I've talked to the CTO because we've had conversations because I think we would love to be in a spot where we could.
Right. But there's a lot of time involved, right? Like you're investing in this person. So you got to go take someone senior and train the junior, which right. takes away their time to actually work. So you need some sort of excess of senior developers, maybe something like that. Maybe there's some balance that we can figure out there. Cause I've thought about that. Like maybe there's a way for Go Rails to help do that with a company. Maybe there's something there that we could do to be able to kind of do some of that training. And again, it's just hard. Like you've got to generally have some easier projects for them to work on. And a lot of times you're building something complicated. So it's not hard to pull off a simple thing.
Yeah. And for us too, like we're such a small team. When we hire more developers, at least right now, because we have more features that need to get out the door. And so we'd like to get in that position. We're just not at the size where we can afford the extra like senior resources. And yeah, maybe one day we'll get there. And maybe that's a thing about Ruby is like, there are a lot of startups, small teams that are using Ruby there's a lot of big companies too, like Shopify is hiring, I don't know, something like 200,000 developers every 10 minutes, but
2,000 is their goal, I think.
Yeah, it's insane. Yeah. But
so my company actually did this really well and still does. And I'm going to preface this conversation with, we are about to start hiring and we're primarily looking for like a mid to senior, but we're open to anything, basically, is what my boss said. So if you're interested in that, maybe by the time this airs, the application will be up. Just go to intopub.com and scroll to the bottom. It'll say careers at home office. Anyway, I was hired as an intern. So I was primarily just learning Rails and Ruby, but I was also learning about how they did Rails and Ruby. And what they did that I thought was really great, and I haven't seen this at other companies before, is that they basically paired me up with a senior, kind of like we were talking about earlier. And but it wasn't like a handhold. Every single week, I met with my mentor at least once a week, and we chatted. And maybe if I needed help with some code, he would help me then. But it was primarily kind of, it was like a mentoring relationship that I still maintain to this day. And that helped me exceed a lot. And I found it to be great. So the other thing that they did very well is it was like an easing, but like they expected things from me. And they basically told me like, this is what we want you to focus on. And since I was an intern, like I knew the types of code I would be working on, but we've hired other juniors. And I've always really appreciated that about the company, that they're willing to hire juniors because they know that it will hopefully pay off. And I think it has for the most part. So please hire juniors, people. I could go on about this and I'm not going to, but I recently was working with a junior and just it turned into a mentoring relationship, but he just found a job. So there's hope.
I feel like we should document that process or something better so that companies can have an easier time of hiring juniors. Because I think that's the concern, is like, will we waste too much time? Is it going to be worth it? It's just a lot of things that are up in the air. But I think if it was nicely documented in a way, like I feel like that was kind of a question about pair programming that Tuple had to address. And I think Ben Orenstein's guides on pair programming was a really good way of addressing that. And maybe we can put some guides together for hiring interns and, you know, and being an intern even. That would be interesting too. Yeah, I think that is some kind of low-hanging fruit that really needs to be addressed in the community. So maybe we can make that happen.
Yeah. I mean, it also depends on like, why are you hiring? Like, why is the company hiring right now? If the company is hiring right now because there's a ton of stuff to do and they need to go fast, then it makes sense that maybe you're looking for a mid to a senior. But if you like have just the ability to hire, like if you get more money in your budget and you can hire someone, that's the time to hire a junior. And I think it really pays off, and it also helps level up your seniors and mids, because I think as the three of us could all agree that teaching others is how you learn the best. So the benefit of hiring juniors is now all of your team gets to be better, as long as it's communicated to the team that like, hey, cultivating that culture where mentoring is a thing and pairing is a thing and it's important, and also focusing on making sure you're not a dick, you know, and having good code review culture, things like that. So there's components of it that I think are important to implement before hiring a junior. It can be like a super successful and beneficial process. And if you're not willing to do that, then not only shame on you, but why, like that sucks. Like now your team is going to get deprived of the benefits of mentoring and teaching and like a new perspective.
Yeah, those are all good points. I think that the point about teaching people is a great way to get better. That is, yeah, that is exactly right. And there's an aspect of it too that, yeah, if you do hire juniors, you're going to be on the radar of so many more people that you're probably going to have an easier time hiring seniors too, because you're going to just generally be more public that way, which is going to be beneficial. I think, didn't Thoughtbot have an apprenticeship program that was really popular? And that's like a good example of using the apprenticeships to make it easier for you to hire just everyone in general. It doesn't have to be juniors or apprentices or anything. It can be, it will attract the attention of seniors too, which is good. Because a lot of seniors want to be able to mentor someone, and that's how they learn and get better. And there's just benefits all around, but it, you do need that culture there though. And that's the foundation of a good company and apprenticeship program and all of that.
Just to tack on to what you said, not only will you get more exposure to seniors, you'll place yourself as a company that seniors will want to come to. And these are seniors who are teachers. And what an awesome thing for your company to get a bunch of seniors who teach, because your code can only get better and your culture can, not only get better, but I think that has long-term payoffs. So it's not only just you'll be more attractive to seniors, you'll be attracted to a certain type of senior.
Yeah, great point. Yeah, maybe we can build a set of docs or something. That would be super cool.
Yeah.
I want to take a moment to thank our sponsor, honeybadger.io. One of the things that's really tricky about error monitoring is that when you get an error, it could have come from anywhere. It could have come from a background job or a user doing some weird thing. They have JavaScript turned off. You never know. And so you might get these stack traces, but you might not know how to debug them. And that is really a pain in the butt. So Honeybadger has a really cool feature called Breadcrumbs. And you can integrate their client-side and server-side libraries so that you can track what was going on when an error occurred. So for example, you have a front end, it has a button to go sign up. Your user clicks that and it makes a post request to your API. And your API has a failure response. And then your JavaScript has an error because, well, something went wrong on the back end. Well, what's really cool is that you're able to track all of that with Honeybadger and see the steps that actually happened in the browser and the server side. So you can go replicate those steps and try it yourself and actually replicate those errors and actually solve the bugs. And that is super cool because if you're just trying to look at the stack trace and you don't know what happened that led to that, it's really tough. So Honeybadger can really save you a bunch of time. I think that is one of my favorite features that they offer. And, you know, like we've said before, they have check-in monitoring. So if you've got cron jobs or like regular scheduled background jobs or anything like that, you can have those check in with Honeybadger and make sure that they're running. So you can feel confident that, yes, your cron jobs actually are running. So that's it. I just wanted to give them a shout out. We love Honeybadger and they've been a long, long time supporter of everyone in the Rails community, and they will continue to be. So check them out. They've got a generous free tier. There's really no reason not to use them.
So did y'all hear about the dependency confusion attack that's been going around the interwebs this week?
Is that like when you gem install Reels instead of Rails? You make a typo? No,
that's typo squatting. It's close. This researcher figured this out, and I'm going to try to explain the low or like the general of it, and then people can go read the actual tech specifics. But basically, if your team has internal gems or internal NPM dependencies or, you know, PyPy or, you know, whatever language, and your internal gem is named, I don't know, store attributes or something. And what this researcher proved is that essentially package managers will default to a public package, even if a private one exists. So if your company is using, they use PayPal as an example. I know they got Shopify. Shopify paid out several tens of thousands of dollars for this bug bounty where the researcher took one of their internal gem names that they found just like scouring their open source repos, and they created a public gem on Ruby gems with that same name. And that public gem just ran a script to basically send information about the computer directly to the researcher's DNS that he set up. Like the dependency manager bundler defaults to the public package. When you bundle install, it then pulls down the public package, even if you have a private one. And then the researcher put like an auto like running script inside of it that basically opens you up to attack. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, it makes sense that it would look at the gems that are publicly available and stuff.
Right. So that's why it's called dependency confusion attack, because basically your bundler and get every other thing is like, it's confused about which dependency to pull because there's conflicting names or there's multiple like packages that could pull. And there's ways to mitigate this, and GitHub had a good blog article today that we'll also put in the show notes about how to specifically prevent this with NPM, but if your company has private gems and you're not using something like GemFury, you definitely would want to check this out and make sure that you're not vulnerable to attack.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. So you're telling me that when DHH posted the gem file for Hey, we could have figured out the turbo stuff early, right?
Not necessarily figured out the turbo stuff, but we could have put a script in there that would have auto, I don't know, RMRF their hard drives or sent us or like just information about their computers.
Yeah. What's in DHH's code directory? Send me all that.
Well, yeah, but then, yeah, so you could steal everyone's code. Then you're in some serious trouble. But yeah, then you get into some deep water.
Yeah. You're like selling the source code for Cyberpunk 2077.
I would buy it. And Witcher. Cyberpunk 2077 and Witcher.
There you go. And supposedly sold on the black market or whatever, which is crazy.
Yeah. Project Red has not been doing too hot recently.
No. Yeah. This stuff is fascinating because there's so much complexity to building a repository of source code that people pull down. And, you know, you can make so many different attacks that way that can confuse people and get you to run code that you didn't expect and whatever. Like, it's a pretty serious thing. We're literally just pushing up source code to Ruby Gems and trusting that it's going to download it and run and it will be what we expected it to be. But yeah, it's a lot easier said than done. And there's a lot of opportunity for malicious things to happen. It's pretty crazy.
Well, just a note, if you're interested in like making sure your Ruby dependencies are secure, there's I hesitate to call it a service. It's not really a service, but because it's free, but maybe it's still a service called DiffEnd, DiffEnd. And it's specifically built for Ruby. It's OSS supply chain security management platform for Ruby applications. And it allows you to manage like risks that come with using open source and third-party dependencies and malware detection, security scanning, and typo squatting checking, and malicious takeovers and ATO attacks and things like that. So this is an awesome free service for Rubyists. So I highly recommend checking that out.
Very nice. What's new with you, Jason?
Finished the course, launched it.
Yay!
Wipes hands. Yeah, it was pretty uneventful, but that's because like early access, right?
Right.
The people who wanted to get it got it early. I had a few sales trickle in this week, but
one of my
coworkers and I were talking. He's thinking about making a course, and his is going to be like what I consider the dream course, where like each video is like an isolated video. It doesn't require like other videos to set up the context. Sounds like the dream.
Yeah, we talked about that not too long ago. Like your course, my Stripe course and stuff, they're all consecutive. You got to watch them one after the other. I just had the fun of doing that this week with the beginner course. All of a sudden, you know, I record that a couple weeks ago and then OmniAuth 2.0 is out and I got to go redo that because people are posting on Stack Overflow and YouTube and the comments everywhere like, this doesn't work. I'm like, it's only like 2 weeks old and it's already broken. And that is the pain of recording a course like that. Cause yeah, it's really hard to jump back into that specific point in time and okay, hello, it's me from the future. This has changed and this might look a little weird, but the alternative being like Ben Orenstein's Refactoring Rails course, the advanced Ruby course that I did, like they're all kind of little independent episodes and that is really easy to redo or whatever if you need to just drop in and fix something or add a new one or whatever. It's just none of them are really connected, which is nice. So that's your dream course.
Yeah. If I do another one, that's what I would try and find is something where it'll get like six videos in and be like, I got this one concept wrong. And now these videos are wrong. I need to go re-record it.
It hurts so much to hear that because I can't tell you how many times I've done like a four-part thing and then been like, I made a typo three lessons ago and I can either leave it or I can just pretend. And it is super painful. Unfortunately, it's not too bad with like Wistia to just replace a video, but like mine were on YouTube, which doesn't let you replace a video. Yeah. You have to publish a whole new one. So that's a real bummer, but even that, just editing an existing thing is pain in the butt.
Yeah. I think the worst is like, I got like six videos done and then I was like, I'm going to have to record like a 10-minute video fixing all the bugs that we made in the last six videos. It was like, I should just re-record these videos. And
yeah, unfortunately. Ugh.
The thing I noticed, which helped me later on, is when I was recording, if a video felt like it was getting too long, I felt like I was doing too much in the video. And so that actually helped too, because I ended up, a 10-minute video might become like 3-4-minute videos. And then I feel like the concepts are easy to understand because they're smaller videos.
Yeah, you're definitely right about that. I tried to do that in my beginner course. And I think towards the end, I started to do too much. But the first videos were, I don't know, 3 minutes each sometimes. And it was so nice to be like, hey, by the way, this is like how a route works. And just talk about that very simply and move on.
Yeah, it also helps me not get like too mentally overwhelmed, because if I'm like 15 minutes into a video, my brain's already kind of fried because I've been talking for at least 15 minutes. The way I record is if I screw up, I just stop and say it until I get it right. So sometimes my videos end up even longer and I'm just, yeah.
Yeah, it is a lot harder than it looks to make a video. Sometimes it just... it would feel nice to do it as a live stream, but then like including the mistakes, but then it's just distracting to have the mistakes, you know, right. Like you really want to edit them out so that it's focused on the actual work that you're trying to accomplish. Not, oh, we made a typo here. Let me go find that and fix it. It's just, it gets you off the track. And that's as much as I would love to include that all the time, it's not as enjoyable to watch or like easy to learn from those videos.
Yeah, I would think that you have probably two different kinds of people though, too. Like you probably have the people that do want to like watch all that. And then there's also the people that just want to see the polished get straight into it. So yeah, it's a tough battle.
Yeah, you can do some of each or whatever, but you got to strike a boundary somewhere.
Yeah. Anyway, I'm happy to have that done. I guess it took me about 2 months to do. I ended up with 4 hours. Just shy of 5 hours, maybe, a video.
Dang. It's good.
Yeah, there are 57 videos. And the point of the course was an introduction to like Simius Reflex and Cable Ready. But when I had finished all the videos, you couldn't create an account with Devise, stuff like that. I was like, we'll clean this up so you don't end up with an app that's not finished. But we won't necessarily go into like inviting team members and stuff like that. I actually linked to some of your multi-tenancy stuff for that.
Yeah, the multi-tenancy stuff gets in the weeds really fast. It would be tangential to what you were doing to get in there too far. Yeah, 2 months is not bad. It's very easy for that stuff to go on for a lot longer than that. I don't know how much time I put into the Stripe course. And that one I had to redo because, you know, SEA changed. And hopefully, fingers crossed, there won't be a massive change in Reflex and Cable Ready for you. But pain in the butt when those things happen, because you're like, great, now I'm going to spend another 2 months redoing this.
Yeah, we'll see what happens. I know some of the stuff, like they're going to make forms opt-in. And like what I may do is just add a video in between there of like, hey, we need to go, this is how we make this form opt-in or something like that, if I can. But so been enjoying not spending every night being like, oh, I need to be recording videos. So
yeah, you get feeling guilty about it. And it is exhausting to do that on top of a full-time job and kids. So
yeah.
Yeah. You've been busy, man. Has it turned out worth it so far?
Yeah. Obviously, like, selling courses is a good feeling. Getting the, I set up Zapier so I get a text whenever it sells. And, you know, I get a little dopamine hit whenever I see Zapier pop up on my phone. But it's been really cool though when like people I don't know tweet about it and say really nice things. That's been the coolest part is, oh, I actually learned a lot out of this and these videos really helped me. Like, that's been really cool. Like, I don't necessarily text Shannon when I sell a course, but every time I get one of those messages, they always make me feel good and I send those to her.
Have you gone on like a PR tour yet? Have you gone to the Reddits?
I kind of avoid. I lurk in R Ruby and R Rails, but I don't have the energy to be a part.
Listener, you have not bought Jason's course, what are you doing? Help Jason get dopamine hits. Buy his course, learn Stimulus Reflex, and if you don't, then you're missing out. Boom, mic drop.
Yes, but buy the course for my own dopamine hits, yes.
Buy the course because you're going to learn a ton, obviously.
But yeah, it's been fun. Me and Andrea started kind of messing around with a side project. I think I messaged you at the end of last year, Chris. Like, I just like burned, but like I burned the f*** out. And I just feel like I'm always trying to like build SaaS apps and make money. So then I just like quit all that. One of the projects I was working on was like a developer on-call rotation app because I don't really love the one we use at work. So I was just kind of hacking on it. And then Andrea messaged me and she was like, I was thinking about this. Where are you on yours? And I was like, well, I've kind of given up on everything. But like, if you wanted to like work on it just for fun, and maybe if we have something at the end where like, this would be cool for other people to use, we could do that. And that's been a lot of fun. Like, I don't have this pressure. Like, I'm not like trying to like put all my eggs in this basket. I spend like an hour a day after work working on it. And it's been a lot of fun. It is solving the issue of a recurring rotation is actually a really interesting problem.
So explain what it does for us.
Yeah. So essentially, like, you need to set a schedule of people to be on call, you know, for like an app going down, and the schedule needs to rotate. And then it also needs to have people, you know, override shifts. And we've been using Simple Calendar. Andrea was like, we should try this. And so like, we put that in to get us started in terms of like just at least getting a calendar on the page. What I'm trying to avoid is creating a rotation by creating all the shifts as database records, because I feel like that's going to be really hard to maintain. So then you have to be able to generate a schedule on the fly. You need to generate that for a given user, a given date, different things like that. For some reason, that problem is a lot harder than I anticipated.
Yeah, it absolutely is really tough, especially when you're like, what's the name of the gems? Montrose, Ice Cube. There's a few of them that are like, you know, we'll generate your recurring event, but you always need exceptions. And it's just like an endless amount of things because you've got time zones and holidays and, you know, all these things. And then, yeah, you could certainly generate it in the database. It saves you a little bit of trouble for rendering, but honestly, it's not that useful because if you ever need to edit anything, good luck. And how far in the future do you render this out? And then if you do it, say 2 years, but a user goes 3 years out, are you going to show them nothing, or are you just going to generate it again on the fly? And then you're like, why didn't I just generate it on the fly anyways?
Right.
So, you know, I could see saving it in the database when it's in the past, so you can keep that history. But really, yeah, if you're building a SaviCal or, you know, this app or a Google Calendar thing, yeah, it makes sense. You would want to just have some logic rules that you say, does it apply to this month or this week or whatever day of the year? It is a very complicated problem. Yeah.
We started kind of simply, you know, you have a participant in the rotation and you can track their position in that rotation. And I was doing a bunch of math to calculate that with modding the participants and who likes on the current shift and like getting the next one for a given date. And it worked until time zones. And so then I went down this huge rabbit hole. Like, Andrea came online one morning and I was like, I've spent all last night reading these white papers on scheduling from Martin Fowler and was doing all this stuff. And then I was, surely this is a solved problem. And that's when I found the Montrose gym. I saw Ice Cube and Montrose. I went with Montrose I don't know if I'm saying it right, but the API is nice because it's a bunch of chainable things. Like, you can say like daily at this time, start it here. So we were able to generate schedules on the fly now that work with time zones. So you can swap from, you know, UTC to Mountain Time and the schedule updates properly.
Real quick, I was going to ask, do you have to also pay attention to Jason's in this time zone and his working hours are from 9 to 5 and we don't want to accidentally schedule him for a rotation at 2 a.m. to 6 a.m.?
We haven't gotten there yet. I'm sure we will. We've been
sorry if I added a to do for you now, a bad one.
I'm dead inside. It's fine. We've been considering those kind of edge cases. We've been modeling it after ours at work right now, which is we each just take a 24-hour shift, like 9 to 9. So we've been starting there and working our way into those cases. So like, I feel like we keep figuring out all these hard problems. And then you're like, okay, how do I test this schedule? The way we're doing is like the current shift, like the person who's on call right now has a shift record. So that way, like it becomes, like you said, history, right? We can keep track of who was on call for a certain date. So we generate the schedule based on the current shift. So our fixtures, because we're not savages, right? We're using mini tests. And so our fixtures have to create a shift for today. So then when you test the schedule, you have to go to a certain point in time to make sure that when you're generating the schedule, it's based on like this current shift. It's, yeah, I wanted a challenge. Here it is. So
yeah. Wow. You got one. That's for sure. Yeah. It'll be interesting to see what learnings and stuff you get out of building that. Cause I feel like that would be a good one to write some blog posts on or something, or make a course out of it. Nope,
not it. Yeah. It's just been fun. Like it feels kind of no pressure. I'm enjoying programming again.
Yeah.
You know, like maybe it's a thing when we're finished, we're like, oh, this is a cool product. It's like people could use this, but I don't know. It's just been nice to solve problems and it's been nice to work with Andrea. I think that's another reason I hate working on side projects is because usually I'm like, I will do all the things by myself. And
yeah. Oh yeah. You can't even think out a problem by yourself. You know, you need another person to be like, what does this make any sense? You know, like, should we even do this? Yeah, that is invaluable. And I agree. Going through school in the computer science program, I remember telling my mom at, I don't know, junior or senior year, being like, I don't even think I like programming anymore. It was just awful, you know? And then doing things that you enjoy turns it around, but it's a fine-edged sword, you know, when you're like, yeah, I got to build this and I got to try and make money and whatever. It just can suck the fun out of building stuff. So I think that's a great idea because that's what I'm doing with 12 and 12 and the job board and those little things. I just want to build some stuff, you know, and I don't care what happens to them. I'd like people to use them. That's the only like accomplishment that I'm searching for, you know. If anybody wants to join that, I bought 12 and 12, the numbers 12in12.io, and you can join us and just post updates on like your projects and whatever, just to get some community around that, some support. Like if you have questions, you know, you can go there and ask whatever. It's not about like building products necessarily, just anything. If you want to learn Rails better or build 12 things, try it.
It's cool. Well, I think we're out of time for today. Thanks for letting me rant about rotations, but
no, that was good. We expect an update next week on how harebrained the not 24-hour rotations end up being and stuff. I think that'll be pretty interesting to see because it's a surprisingly common problem, I think, scheduling events and having them recurring and exceptions and stuff. So I know I've run into that a bunch of times building different apps over the years.
Yeah, we'll see. The moral of the story is don't write tests.
Boom.
Yeah.
I think we should end on that note.
My tests are users in production.
Awesome. Well, great catching up with you guys, and I'll talk to you next week.
All right. See you later.
Later.